Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone to the Rebel Capitalist Show that I've really looked forward to speaking to. He's a rock star on FinTwit. His name is Andreas Steno Larsen. Andreas, welcome to the Rebel Capitalist Show, my friend.
Thank you so much, George.
All right, so can you go over what you do with our viewers? You understand macro, but you're based in Europe. So I thought it'd be fascinating to get you on the show because most of the people I talk to are kind of US-centric, yeah. But there's a bigger world out there.
Yeah, there is. Well, I'm based in Copenhagen, so in the northern part of Europe in Denmark. And I work as the global chief strategist for a bank called Nordea. So we are one of the largest banks in the northern part of Europe, covering basically everything from Germany to the UK, to Scandinavia, Russia, etc. So I know a lot about what's going on here in Europe, but yeah. I obviously also track what's going on elsewhere in the world.
So what's most interesting to you in the world today? What have you been thinking about most lately?
Well, I think that we are very, very far from returning to normal. When I look at all of the trends that we see right now, in particular in inflation, then we're just so far from the environment that we had pre-COVID. And basically what we see right now across the board globally is that people still consume goods in a way that they haven't done in years. So we are way beyond trend when we look at the consumption of goods, while we are still clearly below trend on services. And I think this is a tendency that will continue into next year because we are frankly very far from being able to return to normal, not least when you look at how administrations across the globe, they keep handling this COVID pandemic. So it basically means that all of the tendencies that we see right now in the price setting of goods will continue into the beginning of next year. And again, it will surprise most central banks because inflation hasn't peaked yet.
How has inflation been in Europe? Because we just, you know, you hear it here in the United States and they're saying that it's running at 5 or 6%. Most people here in the US would say it's running way higher than that when you look at the way that the CPI is calculated. But what is it like in Europe right now?
Well, we actually see inflation for the first time in quite a while. Even though I tend to agree with you that inflation is understated in official statistics, then we actually haven't seen inflation to a large extent in Europe over the past couple of decades. So we are more Japan-like compared to the US when we look at inflation in Europe. The reason being that wage growth is very low, but also that actual price growth is very low. So even with the debatable statistics, I would argue that we haven't had a lot of inflation here. So that's in sharp contrast to what we've seen in the US, I think.
But it is increasing there.
Yeah, right now it is. We are stuck in the middle of what I would call an energy crisis, which is much worse than it is in the US. If you look at storages in Germany, for example, on natural gas, which is an important component in the electricity production, then they are running at very, very low levels due to the fact that we are under pressure from Russia. Right now, politicians are negotiating the Nord Stream 2 pipeline with natural gas from northern Russia running through the Eastern Sea to Germany. Russia basically take a very firm stance ahead of this negotiation process. They haven't sent any gas to Germany over the past month or so, which is essentially why natural gas prices have exploded to the upside here in Europe. Very bad news for the German consumer and for Europeans in general.
How do you see that playing out?
Well, I don't think Putin is just after money. He's also after geopolitical stuff. First of all, he wants a swift ratification of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. But secondly, he's also after trying to lessen the strategic importance for Eastern European countries, for the European Union. So basically right now we get most of our gas via landline pipelines, via Poland or Ukraine. Transferring that gas via the sea line would make those countries less important to the European Union, basically. And that's essentially what he's after.
Do you think he's got enough leverage to make that happen?
Probably, yes. I mean, Right now we are in a really bad spot when you look at the negotiation process, since German gas storages, they are running so low that they simply have to cave into his demands. So I'm not an optimist on this process from a European perspective.
So net gas prices go through the roof. That's a large portion of the average Joe and Jane's expenses. It's a large portion of their paycheck. And yeah, so that goes higher, squeezes everything else. Are you guys seeing food prices go up substantially there? I mean, that's what we're seeing here in the US.
Yeah.
Food and housing, food, energy, housing.
Yeah, same here. Just not to the same extent as in the US, but on the energy front, we are worse off.
What has been the ECB's response? What's their narrative?
Well, basically, first of all, they tell us that they cannot do anything about it. And I guess I do agree to a certain extent that they obviously cannot negotiate with Vladimir Putin. So in that sense, they cannot do anything about it. But the rest of the inflation index, they obviously can influence. Hmm. And right now, the communication is basically that they don't see any way that they can influence it.
Have they talked about raising rates?
No. The market started chasing that story. Over the past few weeks, we've seen that elsewhere also in yield curves across the board globally, but markets also started chasing the story in Europe. But then the ECB basically hammered that story back over the past 10 days here, saying that it's out of this world to think of a rate hike next year.
Are they still doing quantitative easing? I'm sure they are, but to what degree? I haven't followed it much at all.
Well, It's been slowing, but it was a really substantial QE program during the height of the COVID crisis. So they're still buying a lot of sovereign debt, and they will continue to do so. I frankly don't see any scenario where they will be able to completely taper this QE program. We have several countries within the European Union that are, I would say, reliant on this QE program running. Italy is a good example, Spain, another example. So they cannot get rid of it.
Let's unpack that a little bit more for the viewer here in the US, because we're just used to just treasuries. That's it.
Yeah.
And you might have state debt and some munis and whatnot, but usually it's just treasuries, where in the European Union, each country has their own bonds, used Italy as an example. And the reason that's important, guys, is because if left to their own devices, Italian bonds would be 10-12% interest rate, something like that. But because the ECB comes and buys them, they artificially keep those interest rates low, which allows, it kind of throws a lifeline to Italy and allows them to continue to spend and not default or devalue their currency, something like that. Am I getting that right?
Absolutely. I mean, the scenario that we had in Europe pre the euro was that Italy, on a running basis, depreciated their currency. And right now, with the common currency in the European Union, we're basically stuck in a situation where the European Central Bank will have to keep these interest rates low on debt in Southern Europe, because if they are left on their own, they will have to pay a completely different interest rate, which they cannot afford, to put it a bit frank. So they will have to keep compressing interest rates as long as we have a common currency.
So they're stealing purchasing power from the average citizen to bail out the governments.
Well, you could argue that, yes. but I mean, and the weird thing is that if you look at surveys in Italy, for example, the population actually supports the common currency to a large degree, which I don't get. Because if I were an Italian, I would actually argue that they would be better off outside. given that they haven't grown their economy at all since they joined the euro.
So you're saying that the Italians favor the euro, or they favor going back to their currency?
They favor the euro.
So okay, and you're saying you're saying they'd be better off because then they could deflate that currency, give them a better advantage with tourists because they'd increase their purchasing power, exports, etc.
Yeah, I think that would be a better choice to get out of the current situation.
Yeah. Okay. So let's go back to the ECB. Do you know how much quantitative easing they're doing per month? Because right now we're doing 120, and Powell's talking about taking it to 105. Are you guys doing about the same there?
Yeah, I mean it peaked around 80 billion a month here in euro terms. If you compare it to the size of the economy, it's pretty much the same. But if you look back to the second quarter of 2020, when the Fed did a lot more per month, then the Fed clearly outpaced the European Central Bank in terms of QE. So still on sort of an aggregate basis since the inauguration of the COVID crisis, the Fed has done more, which is a surprise to me.
How has the market there responded to quantitative easing? Because here in the United States, there's kind of like this Pavlovian response to QE. Yeah. If the Fed's doing more QE, then, well, the market's going to go up, so I'm going to go ahead and buy risk assets. And it's kind of this self-fulfilling prophecy. I'm someone who believes there's not really a direct causal effect for the Fed increasing their balance sheet and the stock market automatically going up. I think it's more of a psychological thing. But how has the market responded in Europe? Has it gone up with quantitative easing, or has there not been a correlation?
Well, first of all, the fixed income market is just dead here because, the ECB is so influent on pricing that volatility has been very, very low.
Does it even trade? I mean, it's like Japan where...
It does trade, but liquidity is getting worse by the month.
Right.
So that's pretty clear. But if you look at the equity market, it has gone up, not to the same extent as we've seen in the US, but it has gone up. And I would argue that... European investors, they've actually been pushed out of the eurozone in terms of their investments rather than staying within the eurozone with the investments. So European asset managers, they've bought US stocks, they've bought emerging market stuff as a consequence of the eurozone being crowded out, basically.
I know that's an argument that I've heard a lot from money managers in the United States for why yields on the 10-year and the 30-year specifically will continue to stay low, or at least have a negative real yield, because we as American investors, we look at it as though it's just this economy. But when you're looking at other pools of money outside of the United States, i.e. Japan, Europe, and they, looking at their yields, comparatively speaking, the 1.5% that you're getting on a 10-year treasury is attractive. Do you think that there's anything to that argument?
Yeah. I mean, if you look at statistics from asset managers, pension funds, et cetera, in Northern Europe, they buy a lot of treasuries, down to that exact argument that, relatively speaking to buying a sovereign bond here in Europe, it's actually a good deal. So that is absolutely the case. You can prove that via actual positioning data.
So do you think that Europe is heading down the path of Japanification, in the sense that the ECB will just one day own 60% of the sovereign debt? And but it seems like you guys are getting a little more inflation there. So how are you?
I mean, I think the only way out of this mess is to construct a European Union with member states that actually bail out each other fiscally. So we would simply need a setup that's much more similar to the US fiscally if we want to get out of this mess. And we're moving in that direction here in Europe. We've set up a so-called recovery fund after COVID, which is a fund that will be allowed to issue common European Union debt, which is then backed up by all member states. Essentially, Germany and the most solid parts of the European Union will back this debt up, and the money will be transferred to Southern Europe. And that is a way of getting out of this mess, because you then simply transfer the credit risk from Italy to Germany.
Are the Germans going to go for that?
Well, they actually tried to contest this in court, but so far they haven't managed. So the court backs the European Central Bank, at least to the extent that they allow the European Central Bank to explain themselves. Also the German politicians back this recovery fund. So for now, yes. And I actually think that, weirdly enough, when we were hit by the pandemic, it immediately allowed for a scope for this recovery fund, because in times of crisis, you can actually get people to stick together,
right?
Also across borders. But before COVID, I would have said that this was impossible.
Hmm. So as far as the productivity in Europe right now, how has it been impacted by the lockdowns? I mean, in the United States right now, you've got states like Arizona, Florida, Texas that are pretty much running at on all eight cylinders. I think for the most part, the United States economy is doing that, with the exception of the labor shortages that have been created by the economic distortions. How is it working in the United States, or in Europe, rather? Do you guys still have some of the lockdowns there? Have government policies, do they continue to impact productivity significantly?
Yeah, they do. But I mean, I would call it they're waning in significance, the lockdowns now. But if you look at the latest development over the past month or so, then we've actually entered the COVID season again. So it seems like they're backtracking on these reopening plans across the board, also here in Denmark, where I live. So we are moving back towards lockdowns, or at least firm restrictions, this winter. So I would expect productivity to take a hit again.
How has that impacted the trade deficit or surplus?
Well, I mean, we are running a clear trade surplus in the European Union, and we've been doing so for a while.
Yeah.
And I mean, if you look through COVID, of course, it's taken a small hit, but we're still running a clear surplus.
Okay.
So that's at least one positive for the Eurozone. It's tricky to go bankrupt when you run a trade surplus.
Yeah.
Essentially, you cannot, in my opinion.
So how do you see that affecting the DXY long term? And just let me explain to the viewers quickly here. The DXY is really, although it's a measurement of the dollar against other fiat currencies, it's mostly the euro. It's a 57%, correct me if I'm wrong, the euro. So you've got one country where the trade deficits are absolutely exploding. That would be here in the United States. We've always run the last few decades, we've run a significant trade deficit, but that has just gone completely parabolic, because now we've maintained demand, if not increased it, but yet the amount of productivity has gone down substantially. So we're still consuming the same amount, if not more. So we're having to import more goods. So more dollars get exported into the global economy circulating, while at the same time, there's an increase or sustained demand for the euro because of those exports. So what do you think that does to the relationship of the dollar and the euro over the next year or two?
Well, I mean, structurally speaking, this should speak in favor of a stronger euro versus the dollar, due to the fact that we import the dollars that you export, right? So in that sense, I would argue that the dollar is in a weak spot if you look at it from a trade perspective on a standalone basis.
Mm-hmm.
But I also find that euro-dollar, that exchange rate, is very linked to relative balance sheet policies between the European Central Bank and the Federal Reserve. So this will also be a contest in terms of who's printing the most. And we are closing in on a scenario where the Fed is printing less than the European Central Bank now, which is in sharp contrast to what we saw in 2020. So my best guess right now is the dollar will strengthen versus the euro if we look at the next 3-4 quarters.
Okay. So when you say that they're printing more, what is the process in which they're printing? Because that's very nuanced phrase, is money printing.
Yeah.
In the United States, the way I look at it
is you've got the government that is deficit spending, and then those bonds are pretty much going right onto the balance sheet of the Fed. So the Fed is creating bank reserves to buy those bonds. So those dollars aren't being sucked out of the system. So when Janet Yellen spends those dollars back into the real economy, you're seeing a net increase in the amount of dollars on the balance sheet of the private entities in the real economy. Is that the same process that you're talking about in Europe, where the governments are deficit spending and it's being monetized by the ECB?
Yeah, at least in parts of Europe, that's the exact same process. But if you look at the deficits in 2020 and 2021, then as a percent of GDP, the US is clearly outpacing even the southern parts of Europe. Mm-hmm. And they've usually been pretty good at spending, I would argue. So, but Biden is outspending everyone, interestingly enough. But the process is exactly the same. The ECB basically transfers euro reserves to bank balance sheets and buying up mostly southern European debt, but also German debt, of course, along the way. But what I miss in the European policy mix compared to the US policy mix is the direct transfers that we saw in the US.
That was my next question. Yeah.
So we haven't seen those to the same extent at all. We've seen small scale experiments, but not in any large scale. So that's a big difference, because I actually think that's a smart way of redistributing printed bank reserves, because they will actually reach the real economy when you do so.
Okay. Yeah, that was, let's kind of dive into that a little bit deeper here. I went over a chart the other day that I received from Joseph Wang. He's Fed guy on Twitter. And we discussed his recent idea that increasing interest rates in the United States might actually exacerbate inflation. But one of the charts he used to illustrate his point is it wasn't just M2, but is M2 broken down by household checking accounts?
Yeah.
And in like the end of 2019, that was about 1.2 trillion. Today it's about 3 trillion.
Yeah.
It's gone up almost $2 trillion. I mean, that is a staggering amount. Yeah. That'll create inflation if you want to create inflation. Yeah. So what you're saying is that Europe, you haven't seen the direct transfer payments or the stimmy checks, if you will, we've seen here. So the balance sheet of the non-bank entity in Europe might look quite a bit different than the non-bank entity in the US right now.
Yeah, it does. And that I think that's the big difference between the policy in the US and in the Eurozone through COVID, the policy mix in the US has simply been more inflationary due to the direct transfers compared to what we've seen in Europe. And that's also why we have such a difference in inflation right now.
Right. And what have you guys experienced the same type of labor shortages there? Because I'm always trying to figure out, you know, why do we have these in the United States? Is it the transfer payments? Is it something else? So if you guys don't have the labor shortages, then that might give us some intel.
Well, we do have labor shortages, but it's a mixed picture across Europe. So if you look at the northern part of Europe, we have massive labor shortages right now. But in the southern parts of Europe, it's not as bad. But still, I mean, directionally, it's the same issue as what we've seen in the US, because large parts of the European Union remain what I would call reliant on incoming labor from, for example, Eastern Europe, but also India. And that's simply not possible to import labor to the same extent right now due to restrictions and border closures and all that.
I see.
And for example, in the country where I live in Denmark, that's a huge issue because, we basically imported labor every year. And it's not as easy right now.
Okay, so that's a lot different dynamic than what's happening here in the United States. That's fascinating. Okay, so let's move from Europe over to China. And we were kind of talking about the dollar, and I think that what's going on in China from a macro standpoint could actually impact the dollar, the DXY. But what is your view with what's going on with Evergrande, Fantasia? I did a story, I think, yesterday on another real estate
entity there that is defaulting on their payments. I'm not sure if they're defaulting on dollar denominated debt or yuan denominated, but what's your view of China right now?
Well, China is really struggling right now. I think that's pretty clear if you look at the market developments. I almost find it amusing that we've seen a 12% drawdown in property developers this week without too many people talking about it, which to me is a sign that no one knows what's going on in
China. Look at their debt too. Their junk debt is yielding like 21% right now.
Yeah. So we've seen crazy market developments in China this week, and frankly, no one is talking about it in the West.
Yeah.
Which is a big puzzle to me. But I basically think that the reason is that no one is getting any info out of China right now. And those who knows what's going on, they are not allowed to speak up. So it's a really tricky scenario to grasp this one. But I'm getting scared of it. I have to admit that.
What metrics do you use to try to determine what's really going on there? I mean, I'm obviously not a professional. So the first thing I would do is maybe try to look at the exports. I'd try to look at the imports to see if they were importing the same amount. What do you use?
Well, the export-import numbers are basically the most true numbers that we have from China, because we can basically correct them ourselves, right? So in that sense, it's probably the best to look at. But otherwise, I track the air pollution over Beijing, because that's also one way of looking at it, which is very, very difficult to manipulate. So we've seen over the past 3 to 4 months, very, very, very low pollution over Beijing, which to me is a sign that the activity is low, because otherwise the pollution would have gone up.
Right.
So there are signs that they're actually struggling to produce the same amount of goods that they've usually produced. So I guess when we actually get the numbers out of China that we can be certain of the validity of, then we will have it will basically be a testimony of a complete slowdown in China. Maybe not a recession, but a very, very marked slowdown.
Why do you think Xi Jinping is allowing that to happen? Why do you think he's not stepping in, assuming that he's not?
Well, this is him trying to regain control of a economy going wild. If you look at the developments in the real estate sector in China over the past 5-7 years, then we've seen material yearly increases in the price levels. If you look at the affordability of real estate in Beijing, for example, then price is like 20 times disposable income, right? 20
right.
times income.
Yeah, yeah.
While if you look at the average price of a home in the US or in Europe, if you really find the most expensive spots, then we are probably running at 10, 15 times income, right? So China is the worst country in the world to buy real estate if you are a regular Joe. That's essentially an issue for Xi Jinping down the road if regular people, they start debating whether he's the right man, right?
Yeah.
So I think he's starting to look very defensive in a way. And he's starting to break down all kinds of sectors to try and regain control of the economy.
Regain, and then hopefully, you know, they might go through a slowdown, but they're trying to kind of land it soft instead of having a really hard landing. You had a hard landing in a country with, let's say, 1.5 billion people. From a standpoint of social unrest, that's a lot different than a country of how many are in Denmark, or even the United States, a country with 350 million. That's one thing that Americans just really don't realize, that the political dynamics there are very, very different.
Yeah. We are only 5 million here, so I wouldn't argue that we have a lot of influence in the global economy. But I mean, in terms of China, we already know that the slowdown is there, and it will have repercussions for right about every part of the world into next year. We've seen how China has been leading the global cycle over the past 10 years to a larger and larger extent.
Yeah.
And I basically think the same will happen next year. We will see a slowdown everywhere. as a consequence of what's going on in China right now.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
I was trying to think of how that may impact the dollar the other day. And let me tell you kind of my ideas, and you can say, George, that's ridiculous, or yeah, you might be onto something there. I read a study that showed they import about $2 trillion worth of stuff per year. Import. And I thought, okay, well, if they go through a recession, and let's just say that they're importing half as much, that may be too much, but just as a thought experiment. So their imports go down to $1 trillion. We know that a lot of those imports are actually settled in dollars. I don't know if that's 50%, 60%. I know globally, usually, you know, about 60%. So assuming that $600 billion of those imports that they used to have were settled in dollars, that means that there's $600 billion less dollars going out of China into the global economy. And then I think, okay, well, that's just basically dollar-denominated cash flow for a lot of these corporations. And a lot of these corporations have a lot of dollar-denominated debt. So that debt payment every single month doesn't change, just like a household. But yet their dollar cash flow is decreasing significantly. And therefore, it makes it harder to pay that debt, to service the debt. Therefore, they end up either having to take their local currency cash flow, go into the FX market, and then trade that for dollars, which would increase the demand for dollars, increase the supply of, let's say, the Colombian peso, or they just have to sell their some of their dollar-denominated assets. And this creates this kind of dynamic that could increase the demand for dollars outside of the United States and outside of China on the global market. Do you think there's something to that, or is that just an insignificant cross current?
No, I think you are leaning in the right direction. I also bet that the dollar will gain versus the Chinese yuan over the next year. The reason being that global trade is essentially the key source of dollar liquidity for foreigners. So when global trade drops, exactly as you describe it here, then we tend to see a stronger dollar. So have a look at that in a historical perspective. If you look at the monthly volumes of traded goods versus the DXY index, for example, then there is a very, very strong correlation due to the exact mechanics that you described here. So I think that's essentially the reason why you should expect the dollar to gain versus Chinese yuan.
Let's look at the opposite side of the equation. If we are to say, okay, the dollar is going to lose its reserve currency status, and I'm not saying it happens tomorrow or anything. Let's just say this is going to happen maybe in 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, something like that. What metrics would you look for to see that we were gradually moving in that direction? One of the numbers I've looked at, and I thought, okay, this would probably make a difference, is just global dollar denominated debt. And I thought, okay, well, you know, if, like, let's look at the petrodollar for a moment. If Saudi Arabia starts selling a lot more of its oil to Russia based in rubles, then that's less dollars that are required. If that happens more consistently throughout time, then there's less dollar denominated debt that these corporations would force to be taken on. And therefore, if there's less dollar denominated debt, that creates less demand for dollars in the future. And that's kind of what triggered or is kind of indicative of that process playing out. So should I be putting as much of an emphasis on dollar or global dollar denominated debt? Or what are your thoughts there?
I think that's a good idea. I mean, I speak a lot to central bank reserve managers during a year, and they basically have a couple of important prerequisites before they add a currency to their reserve basket. First of all, they need a liquid bond market to invest in with the reserve currency. So I guess the dollar is still, you could put a check mark in front of that for the dollar, certainly. Right. But you can certainly also start putting a check mark in front of that slowly but surely for China. Mm-hmm. Secondly, it's very, very important for reserve managers whether the currency is used to settle trade. So exactly as you're saying, if commodity producers start selling the commodities in other currencies and actually settle them in other currencies, that would be a massive game changer. And it's exactly what China is trying to manufacture. They want more and more of global trade to move into yuan settlements. But I don't think they can force that process unless they put tanks on the ground in large portions of the world. But they will try to force that process via the new e-yuan that they intend to launch next year.
I was going to ask you, the digital yuan and the Belt and Road Initiative. Do you think that has something to do with it?
Exactly. If you look at it right now, compared to just 10, 15 years ago, China is essentially the biggest trade partner for a lot of countries worldwide compared to the U.S. And that was upside down just 15 years ago. So it essentially means that over time, the incentive to settle more and more of your trade in yuan will grow since China is your biggest trade partner. So I think, I mean, if we're talking about the next 20, 30 years, then China currently holds the upper hand in this debate.
Let's pull it back to just what's happening right now in China. I just spoke at the New Orleans Investment Conference. I had dinner with Brent Johnson. Yeah. And I think that day that I got on the flight, I saw that China had just issued another $4 billion in dollar-denominated debt. So I was trying to, okay, well, why are they doing this? And I went over that with Brent. I wanted his input there. And we were talking about maybe their banks are short of dollars that they need to provide liquidity to some of these real estate companies that are maybe trying to roll over that dollar-denominated debt. Another thought maybe they need that to buy more coal. I believe they're having an issue right now with energy, so those payments might need to be settled in dollars. Do you have any insight on that?
Well, my best guess would be that this is linked to the energy crisis.
Okay.
Because first of all, China has promised the IOC to deliver less air pollution in Beijing than what they have right now ahead of the Winter Olympics next year. So what they do right now is that they buy more natural gas than coal to just ensure that air pollution is lower. And they need dollars to buy these commodities still.
Right.
So that would be my best guess. But obviously, if you look at Evergrande and the real estate sector, there could be an issue in terms of dollar liquidity there. But if you look at the dollar denominated debt, it's not that big.
With those entities?
Yeah,
I didn't realize that. Okay.
But if you look at Evergrande, it's like $18 billion out of 300 directly linked in dollar.
Okay.
So that's not a whole lot. So I would put more emphasis on the energy crisis because that's really something that's terrifying in China as well.
Focusing on energy. I've talked to a good buddy of mine who runs a hedge fund. His name's Chris McIntosh, and he was saying, you know, George, in the future, especially with oil and maybe coal, or maybe even gold. I know Russell Napier was talking about that the other day on Macro Voices, but he said, typically in a free market, the cure for high prices is high prices. But he said, I don't know if that's going to play out in the future because it's the political narrative. Maybe it's the right thing to do. I'm not going to get into that debate, but there's so little capital going into creating more supply of these commodities that it doesn't matter how high the price is going to go. There's still not going to be any more supply come online to create that equilibrium. How do you see that moving forward?
Well, if you look at the CapEx in this sector right now, then it's almost at a 20-year low.
Right.
And I think the reason is that a lot of funds, a lot of investment managers have moved their mandates towards ESG mandates.
Yeah, that's what I was implying. Yeah,
it's essentially very tricky to attract capital to this sector at the moment. I hope that the current crisis that we are basically standing right in the middle of here in Europe and also in China will at least temporarily reverse that trend. But I'm not sure, because if you look at the response from politicians, they basically just tell people that they will put up more windmills as a consequence of this, right?
Yeah.
And I'm not sure that that strategy will be proven right over the coming decade, but at least it's still the strategy that most politicians are following.
Yeah. So how do you think that plays into commodity prices over the next, let's say, 3 years or so? Because I know commodity prices, at least, I believe iron ore has really taken a hit because of what's happening in China. I think they represented about 50% of global demand.
Yep.
So companies like Rio Tinto, where I think that's about 40% of their revenue, they've obviously taken a hit. But I was just trying to think, okay, copper's come down a bit, maybe nickel's come down a bit because of what's happening in China. Is that maybe a headwind short term? But we've got to look at the bigger picture and say there's a lot more tailwind long term.
Yeah, I think there's a lot more tailwind long term for such commodities. But I think you're also right that the latest price developments, they are clearly linked to what's going on in the commercial real estate sector in China, because if construction activity is down, then these commodities will also take a hit. One thing that could play an important part in the pricing of, for example, copper as well, is that windmills, solar panels, all of these renewable energy sources, they require a lot of copper. If politicians, will keep pursuing this renewable strategy, then we should expect that demand to pick up markedly in the next decade. So I would argue structurally that we've entered a bullish scenario for commodities, but I'm not too bullish industrials short term due to what's going on in China. I think we will have lower commodity prices in the exact sector that you just asked for in a year from now, maybe 20-25% even.
Do you think that will materially affect the inflation rate in the US and Europe?
Well, on a headline basis, yes. But I think we will move from sort of a supply chain driven inflation scenario right now to a wage to price spiral next year, given what we see from leading indicators on wage growth. We saw how the wage growth exploded in the US during the latest quarter. We've also seen tendencies towards the same in Europe. So we will see inflation from the labor markets next year, not from commodities.
And historically, hasn't that been the main catalyst to sustained levels of inflation?
Definitely. Which is why I think right about every central bank is wrong on inflation right now. Watching Jay Powell on Wednesday, it's very clear that they have no clue what to do ahead of 2022. First of all, they're stuck in a narrative that they find increasing evidence is wrong. That's always tricky to backtrack from.
You talk about the inflation transitory narrative.
Exactly. It's very tricky for them to backtrack, because they were, in my humble opinion, very, very cocky on this 2-3 quarters ago. They essentially told all of the people calling for high inflation that we were idiots. And now that we're standing in the midst of inflation and with signs of increasing wage inflation, they struggle to come up with a good storyline on how to address that. And it's the same for most of the big central banks in the West.
The question I keep asking is, how long can inflation be transitory? Like if we've had inflation for like 5 years, is it still transitory? I mean, at what point do we have to kind of wave the white flag? I don't know. Go ahead.
You have to ask Jay Powell on that. I don't think it's transitory already now. I think there are permanent layers to it already now.
So do I. I think that a lot of what has created the inflation, in my opinion, has been these economic distortions created by the U.S. government. And I don't see those distortions going away. I think that they will actually increase in the future. They won't decrease. But as far as, let's just assume for a moment that inflation does continue to stay at high levels in the United States or in Europe. What is the next move for the central banks? Let's just assume that inflation gets up to a level where it's really putting the squeeze on the average Joe and Jane to the point where they're cognizant of it and they're really making noise. What does the central bank do then? Also understanding that there's so much debt out there at a sovereign level, a corporate level, and a consumer level, that raising interest rates significantly could impact the overall economy, maybe even more so asset prices.
Well, there is no way that they will allow real rates to turn positive again due to the current debt load. I think it's the only sort of politically palatable solution long term. It is to just keep real rates negative for as long as needed to bring debt levels in real terms down. So of course, if you get 10% inflation, let's just assume that, then I would argue that they could raise nominal rates, but they will still have to keep real rates as low as they are now. So that will be the threshold. They will have to keep real rates very, very low and clearly in negative territory. There is no way out of it.
I'd like to get your view on this idea that Joseph Wang had. And so hopefully I can do justice to it here with my summary. But basically, he pointed out the fact that the system the commercial banks have, or the relationship with the Fed, has changed significantly since the GFC. Prior to the GFC, the money markets, basically the banks would lend to each other, and if the Fed wanted the interest rate to go down or up, they would just buy some more treasuries or more direct securities or sell them, and that would provide the more dollars. The more dollars there are, the interest rate that goes down, or the more liquidity it is for banks to lend to one another. But when you do QE, you flush the system with all of these reserves. So regardless of what you want the interest rate to be, it would be at zero. There's really no way for the Fed to increase interest rates if they're doing quantitative easing at the same time. So the solution to that was IOER, or IOR, interest on reserves. So then, regardless of what or how much liquidity is in the system, how many bank reserves are out there, Bernanke says, we'll pay you 1%, we'll pay you 2%, or and I'm just using Bernanke as an example. So therefore, the banks are incentivized to only lend money at a rate higher than the Fed is paying them for their reserves, which is basically a risk-free rate, if you will. So he says, since that dynamic has changed, the banks are no longer competing with one another for deposits. Because prior to that, they're competing for deposits because that was the cheapest form of reserves they could get. But now there is no competition because they don't really need any more reserves. They got all they can handle. You know, the amount of reserves in the system has gone from, call it, 40 billion to up over 4 trillion. So his theory is that if they raised IOER even up to 5 or 6%, let's say, the interest rate they're paying the customers still around maybe 20, 30 basis points. And therefore, that delta is all profit that's going to the banks and additional bank reserves. So what do they do with that? They try to get a little bit bigger return. So they go out and buy treasuries.
But he said, since the United States right now is having an issue with the debt ceiling, assuming they continue to have the problem moving forward, that means Janet Yellen is issuing fewer bonds that the Fed is able, or that those banks are able to buy. If they're able to buy fewer bonds, then they're going to go into the private sector. And if the banks buy bonds or assets from the private sector, the non-bank entities, that is increased money creation, because that's creating dollars that didn't exist before. And then he went back to that chart of the dollars in the deposit accounts of households just going parabolic up $2 trillion. And he says that if interest rates rise because the banks buying assets from non-bank entities with their additional profit, that could increase the amount of dollars circulating in the real economy. Do you have a view on that?
I think that thesis is fair. And it's probably exactly why the Federal Reserve is so keen on removing excess reserves during a process of rate hikes. Right. We saw that in 2018, 2019, right? And it ended with a big bang. But essentially, they wanted to withdraw liquidity or excess reserves from banks in the process of raising interest rates due to fearing this exact mechanic. So they haven't really told us whether they intend to experiment with withdrawing liquidity again this time around. Right now, they withdraw liquidity via the reverse repo, because without that, we would have had massively negative interest rates in the US already now. That's kind of flooring the interest rate levels at 5 basis points.
Yeah, right.
Since the Fed is paying that, right?
And just to be clear, Andres, you're talking about reverse repo, where the Fed is the counterparty. So we have all these money market funds that are flushed with those dollars that we just talked about, and they're taking those dollars, and instead of parking them, or instead of them being liabilities of commercial banks, they park them at the Fed, so they're liabilities on the Fed's balance sheet.
Yeah. So that's one way of actually withdrawing the liquidity or the excess reserves without having to withdraw the excess reserves permanently. So I actually think that the introduction of the reverse repo and the increase of counterparty levels has solved part of the issue that Joseph lists here.
So
I'm not as scared of it as I was in 2018. But it's still a struggle for the Fed, because obviously they need to think of ways to remove liquidity into a rate hiking scenario, because otherwise they won't get rates up.
Right. So with this environment that is, I think, becoming maybe more obvious to the average talking head at CNBC or maybe fund manager, what is going on with gold?
It's a big puzzle. I the only concrete explanation I can come up with is that we've seen an introduction of digital gold, that's maybe the right reason why it's not performing. Because if you look at current real rate levels, then I would argue that gold should trade at least above 2,000, but it's not.
So
I mean, historical correlations, they've broken. We simply have to admit that.
Yeah. So do you see that correlation being broken longer term, or just being kind of a shorter term anomaly?
Well, let me put it like this. If I were to construct a portfolio, then I would like to have a bit of gold in the portfolio to protect myself against the scenario where we reintroduce the gold standard. But I would also like to have a bit of digital assets in my portfolio to protect myself against the scenario where we actually link the monetary policy to a digital asset, right?
Right.
So I think the probability of returning to the gold standard is much lower today than before the digital assets. And maybe that's one reason why we've seen this decorrelation between real rates and gold, that the probability of returning to the gold standard is now lower. Right. Or the probability of entering into a Bitcoin standard, if I may.
I thought you were talking about Shiba Inu.
I tweeted earlier this week, when will we see a cat coin? I hate dogs. I love cats more.
I'm sorry to cut you off. I had to say that though. Okay, so the probability maybe is increasing that we could get a Bitcoin standard, and maybe decreasing slightly that the next phase is a gold standard when the fiat regime kind of comes crashing down.
Yeah, I basically think that's the rationale behind portfolio construction right now, and that's essentially why we see the price action that we do.
Awesome. Andreas, great conversation, buddy. For my viewers and listeners who want to find out more about what you do, where should they go?
Go to Twitter. My name is Andreas Steno there. So have a look in there.
Awesome. Thanks for the conversation. Can't wait to do it again.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Hi, guys. I'd like to invite each and every one of you to the next Rebel Capitalist live event. If you are a fan of the Rebel Capitalist show, I guarantee you will love the live event. The next one is Houston, where you can meet and listen to speakers, all your favorites from the Rebel Capitalist show. People such as Dr. Ron Paul, Chris Cole, Lynn Alden, just to name a few. If you want to check out the rest of the speaker list and find out how you can attend, we'll put a link in the description below, or you can just go to rebelcapitalistlive.com. This is an event where you can learn to build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. But it's not just about building wealth. It's about increasing your freedom and networking with like-minded individuals, fellow rebel capitalists. It's an amazing event. I know you'll absolutely love it. Check out rebelcapitalistlive.com, and I will see you in Houston.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.